This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello!
Hello!
Well, I don't know if you'd be able to tell just now listening to this, but we are out
on
and
location.
About. We are on location. We are en route.
Yeah.
We're out on the street because the episode is about walking, so we thought we'd come for a walk. How are you enjoying this?
I'm really enjoying it.
I wondered if we should get our phones out. You know your phone is tracking how many steps you do a day.
Oh, good thinking.
I wondered if we could compare who does the most steps in a given day.
You know, I'm not sure whether I think I'd like a sort of, I think this might be the Iowa caucuses, this thing, because I don't think it's kind of right. I mean, I'm sorry to sort of be a pain in the neck.
So does it give you your average across
the
year?
Well, the week of the 27th of January,
yep.
It says 6,366 steps per day, which seems small.
Do we think mine is higher or lower?
Higher.
It's 13,279.
You are not serious.
It's just gone up to 280 because of what we're doing now.
I can't believe your numbers. Let's just look at, how do you look at the year?
You're so competitive. It's really upsetting you that one of my metrics is higher than yours.
What's the, you walk Jean to nursery, do you?
Walk Jean to nursery, Harvest over there where I buy my groceries.
Looks nice shop.
Yeah. If I went in there, Ed, I promise you, it'd be like Cheers where everybody knows your name.
Do you think, should we try that?
Well, yeah, now I feel like that.
Let's not get run over.
I'm not going to get acknowledged at all. There's my guy. You see, he's smiling at me. I'm very, very well liked in this supermarket.
Really?
Yeah. You see, that seems surprising to you. Hi, you're right. Yeah, I'm well. How are you?
Good.
You busy?
Yeah.
He's good. He's at nursery today. Yeah. See, I told you, I'm very well liked in this supermarket.
You are well liked.
Yeah.
That's two people.
Look at that.
But also,
look at that.
It's like quite uncharacteristic of you that you do, you're normally so sort of misanthropic.
I am misanthropic, but what I'm good at, because I'm needy to be liked, I'm good at these short interactions.
Right. I'm like desperately.
Somebody just said hello to you. Or did you sort of get right into someone's face and say, it's me, Ed Miliband?
Yeah, I was more like that, to be honest. I was sort of like, it was kind of needy selfie moment.
Why are we on a walk? What is walking in context of this episode?
Well, we're talking about walking. We're talking to Shane O'Mara, who is a neuroscientist, about the benefits of walking. I think we kind of know that there are benefits, but he's really compelling. Then we are going to be talking to Joe Irvin, who runs the Living Streets organization, formerly the Pedestrians Association, and Susan Claris, who is a transport planner and works for Arup.
And then our cheerful person this week is somebody, I'm guessing you've known her whole life. Her dad is Alistair Campbell, and she does a podcast with him, which is why I mention him. But away from that, she is an up-and-coming comedian in her own right. She's got a lot of stuff going on. It's Grace Campbell.
Yes.
So what's your reason to be cheerful then?
My reason to be cheerful is that at the initiative of my wife, all good things happen at the initiative of my wife, we've started to go on family film trips.
Oh.
Cinema.
What, Saturday morning?
Sunday afternoon, actually.
Right, right. And what did
you
go see?
So far, we went to see The Private Life of David Copperfield.
How was that?
Good. And Little Women.
And how was that?
It was good, and it was good to take our two boys to Little Women. They really enjoyed it. But I'll tell you what, the cinema thing was definitely cheerful. But I there was an experience which immediately made me think of you. It was kind of slightly posh cinema, and they made a little announcement about not having your mobile phone on, and the man said, enjoy the show. And then about three-quarters of the way through, I thought I'd take a quick sneaky peek at my phone.
Ed!
And literally, he was then, like, within about 5 seconds, he was there saying to me, I'm afraid, sir, you're going to have to turn off your mobile phone. It was quite embarrassing. In a
I can't believe you did that.
Small cinema.
I thought better of you. I can't believe you did that.
But I was quite impressed by the speed of response. I mean, it was like, you know, the armed police sort of arriving.
So he's scouring the audience constantly.
Do you think he must be,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, I respect him for that. I want more people
you
like that.
You approve of that, don't you?
Yeah, very, very strongly.
And what's your reason to be cheerful?
My reason to be cheerful, I mentioned it last week, but then it happened. I went to Mamma Mia, the party.
Oh, yes, I've been waiting for the report back. What was it like?
It was incredible. As I mentioned, it's a replica of the Greek taverna from Mamma Mia.
Yeah.
You go and have a meal, and while you're having the meal, the waiting staff act out a play, which is different to Mamma Mia. It's not the same story. It's set in the same cinematic universe, yeah. I believe-ish. But there's lots of songs. And we weren't in the most expensive seats. We were high up on a balcony.
Right.
Guess who comes walking along where we're sitting?
Bill Clinton.
No, better than that.
Hillary Clinton.
Better than that.
Barack Obama.
I'm going to... No, not quite as good as that.
Give me a clue.
We were at Mamma Mia the party. I think the clue is in the setting of the...
Bjorn Ulvaeus.
Yes! Yes!
No!
Yes! I was too starstruck and shy to go over and say hello to him.
I mean, there is an irony here, which is that on Bjorn's podcast, he'll be saying, you'll never guess who was at Mamma Mia the musical.
I'll tell you what I did do. I went over to the table that he'd been sitting at,
yeah.
and I got a friend to take a picture of me with his napkin tucked into my shirt and holding up the glass that he'd been drinking from.
Well, that is... Do you think you'd recommend it for me?
No, I don't think you'd enjoy it unless you could guarantee that Bjorn was going to be there. I think a lot of people would enjoy it. I just don't think it's for you. You don't like a musical.
Was there a lot of getting up out of your seat? Were you singing along?
Oh, yeah, sing along. I'm just not
while sitting?
Yes. I'm not a good mover.
Right.
I've not got rhythm.
You're listening to Reasons to Be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
We have on the line in Dublin Shane O'Mara, who is a professor of experimental brain research at Trinity College. He's author of a fantastic book called In Praise of Walking. Shane, hello.
Hello. I'm delighted to be speaking with you.
He's the walking champion of all walking champions, really, isn't he?
He is the walker of all walkers. We were just saying before we turned the microphones on, big, big fans of walking in all its form here, ambling, pottering, strolling, striding, rambling. I mean, give me any of them. You argue that walking is what makes us human. What do you mean by that?
I think, you know, humans, and I do make this case, walk in a distinctly different way to all other animals, and we undergo a transition that is quite unlike any other species on the planet. You know, if you think back to when you were a kid or when you observe other kids, they crawl around on all fours. And then around about a year or so of age, they make this dramatic change where they start to sit up, they start to pull themselves up, and they go from a stable to a very unstable position. But my argument is very straightforward, that without this transition, our brains wouldn't be mobile in the world in the way that they are. Our hands would not be free. So this kind of change is the core of the kind of change that allowed us to walk out of Africa and conquer the planet.
Well, that's a pretty big deal then.
Yes, I think so.
I think it's time for a bit of Kierkegaard. I think it's his first appearance on our podcast, but you quote him in your book, "Every day I walk myself into a state of well-being and walk away from every illness. I have walked myself into my best thoughts, and I know of no thought so burdensome that one cannot walk away from it." Your case is it's good for mental and physical health, yes?
Yeah, absolutely, that it's good for body and brain. And, you know, just let's take the body just for a moment. We humans are, again, doing a very strange thing to ourselves. We might spend, I guess, maybe 50 or 60 hours a week sitting around, which is something that we've never done before. We need to counteract this tendency we have towards a sedentary lifestyle. And the easy and obvious thing to do is to get up on our feet and get moving. And we know that the very act of walking changes things in your breathing, changes your heart, changes the stress and strain that you place on your muscles. It's good for you in myriad ways in terms of how your body functions, but it is also remarkably good for you in terms of how your brain functions as well.
Tell us a bit more about that.
If you're seated at the moment, I'm standing and walking while I'm talking to you in my office. But if you're seated,
You got one of those treadmills or are you just walking around?
No, I'm walking diagonally across from one corner of my office to the other.
Wow. Do you do that a lot?
I am hoping to get a treadmill desk, but I haven't got one yet. There are all sorts of ones out there. So anyway, that's kind of a by the by. So when you're seated, you're not actually placing much strain on any part of your body apart from the small of your back, which is why you might have a lower back pain. But when you stand, everything changes for you. Your breathing changes. The brain has to do something which it hasn't had to worry about before, which is maintaining stability. So getting upright and staying upright is no mean achievement for a brain. And a whole series of rhythms that previously were quiet in your brain suddenly kick into play. And everything changes for you. Your hearing becomes a little bit sharper. Your vision becomes a little bit sharper. Your brain is readied for action. And I argue in the book that the reason we have a brain is for movement. You don't need a brain if you're not moving around in the world. And because we have a brain that's built for movement, we should take advantage of that.
And it does something to your creativity.
Yeah. So what we know from observing the great artists of the and novelists and others of the generations is that they walk and they walk a lot. So Immanuel Kant, one of the greatest philosophers of all time, you could set the clock by him in Königsberg. Stephen King, the novelist, walks an astonishing amount. And we can demonstrate experimentally that people become a little bit more creative after short periods of walking around the world. So a very simple way of doing this is if you're seated at your desk and you pick up a pen or some one of the other objects that might be lying around, and you have to ask yourself, how many uses can I come up with for this object? So this is a kind of an alternative uses task. If you're seated and you do this task, you might come up with 4 or 5 or 6. But if I get you to walk around for 10 minutes before you do tasks like this, the numbers of ideas that you generate approximately doubles.
Amazing.
Yeah, and there's also something else that's really important about this finding. It has recently been replicated in Taiwan with a group of people in their 70s. What you find is that people in their 70s who walk for a short period prior to generating ideas come up with about twice as many of them as do seated 20-year-olds.
Wow.
So this is, I think, you know, one of these kind of overlooked little tricks to ensure that you keep some degree of creativity as you get older.
Now, Shane, give us some advice. How much should we be walking each week? And how should we be walking more?
We should all be walking an awful lot more. So the average child, when it learns to walk, does about 2,300 steps per hour, which is a lot. When you consider that the average adult in a Western society does about 4,000, 4,500 steps a day. So not very much. The Japanese are the best at walking. They do about 5,500 steps a day, which is really not so much. Whereas our people who are living what are sometimes referred to as ancestral lifestyles, they will walk 15 kilometers a day and they have astonishing heart health.
So they're the people that live in the blue zones around the world and live to like 120.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
What's 15 kilometers in steps?
So I think, you know, we've all heard this 10,000 steps a day thing. That was a marketing thing for pedometers in the 60s. But it actually, I think, is quite useful because 10,000 steps, if your stride length is a meter, is more or less 10 kilometers. So if you can do 10,000 steps a day consistently, that's what you need to do. But what I would suggest is you do it in bursts across the day rather than exhausting yourself in one go. We're built to do kind of distributed activity. So you can easily hack out 10 or 12,000 steps in a day. Some of it should be at speed. It should be difficult to speak when you're doing it. You should break a moderate sweat. So let's say 6 kilometers an hour. Which is hard in a city.
This is the bit I struggle with.
I was going to ask about this because to go into sort of controversial territory, what's the balance between sort of walking and running or walking and cycling or walking and swimming? But your thing is really, it can't just be sedate walking. It's got to be, you've got to sort of get your heart rate up, don't you really?
Yeah. So I think you need to ask yourself what the purpose of the walk you're going on is. So if you're going to have a think and a chat with yourself about a difficult problem, maybe not pump out the power walk, maybe do it at a little bit of a slower rate. But if you're doing it for the purposes of cardiac health You know, doing 30, 40 minutes at about 6 kilometers an hour is kind of the territory you want to be in. I don't want to come across as being anti-runner or anti-cycling or anti-swimming. I think these things are all great activities. I suppose the one thing I'd say about running is that per million steps run as opposed to per million steps walked, what you see is runners injured themselves rather a lot, whereas walkers hardly injured themselves at all. The level of injury is kind of flat. So running does present certain problems. Our cities aren't good for running. You can turn on your ankle, you can fall, you can do quite a few things that you mightn't do when you're walking.
Can we talk about town planning and, you know, what kind of thought can be given to town planning in the interests of walkers? And also, you've got this idea that psychologists and neuroscientists should be involved in that. Tell us a bit more.
I guess the point really is that, you know, when you think about where people want to go in our towns and cities, they want to go to places where other people are. So the tourist attractions in London, just to take an example, are places like Covent Garden. There are no cars present in Covent Garden. People aren't going to the A40 West to meet with others, except if they're maybe nerdy motorway enthusiasts. But but the more general point is that we need to make our towns and cities have thoroughfares that are places that people want to be. In other words, we need to stop thinking of thoroughfares as places for cars. We need to think of them as destinations for people. And that means the kinds of things that are interesting to us psychologically need to be built into them. They need to be beautiful. They need to be green. They need to have boundedness. They need to have a quality known as porosity. So there must be lots of angles and intersections and places that people can tangentially meet each other by accident. And I don't sense from our current generation of town planners that they think of people as anything other than the kind of awkward bits of squashy flesh that really should be contained in cars.
Can I
no
just ask?
No offense to any of the town planners who are listening.
Turn them against us.
An exception, obviously, to that. Right. We have a thing on the podcast, Shane, called the Jeffocracy, which is where Jeff is the supreme ruler. If he made you, which I think, frankly, he should, the Minister for Walking.
Not Minister for Silly Walks.
Not Minister for Silly Walks, no. What's the first thing you would do?
Ban all city centre car parking.
Oh.
Car parking, not
yes.
Cars.
No, people won't bring their cars into town if they've nowhere to park them.
Ah, interesting.
And devote all of those car spaces to widening footpaths, to bringing in small micro-environments, to providing stands for bicycles, and to creating space for fixed-line transport like trams.
Wow. Sounds good. Now, I've been standing up for the sort of second half of this interview. Is standing up a good thing?
Standing is better than sitting, without any doubt. But there's no reason why you couldn't be walking if the space allows you to. So I've been walking continuously since we started this, and I guess I've done about 1,500 steps in that period.
Wow. It's a revelation. You are the champion walking advocate of all walking advocates. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Now, to talk further about what we can do and the vision for walking, I'm glad to say that we're joined by Joe Irvin, Chief Executive of Living Streets, and Susan Claris, who's a transport planner and currently Associate Director of the engineering firm Arup. Thank you so much both for joining us. Joe, tell us, first of all, what's the story behind Living Streets and what do you do?
So what we are is we're a charity, we're the UK charity for everyday walking. And we started back in 1929 and we were called the Pedestrians Association. And why? Because suddenly there was motor traffic suddenly building up and not much control over it. So there were 6,000 people killed that year on the roads with only a million motor cars. So what did they want? They wanted pedestrian crossing. So were the people who brought you the zebra crossing ultimately.
Yeah.
They wanted a driving test before you drove cars, which didn't come in for quite a long time, amazingly. And they wanted a speed limit on the roads, which didn't exist at the time. So those came in
amazing.
In the 1930s. But nowadays what we do is we campaign, we advise on good kind of streetscapes. And we also deliver projects around the country, most notably Wild Walk to School.
We've heard from Shane what he thinks the health benefits of walking are. When you advocate for walking and for living streets, what's the sort of case you make?
Yeah, well, so, I mean, physical activity is really important, but there's also the environment, and this is probably an increasing concern. So probably a year or two ago it was air quality, but I think climate change has come back as a major issue. And people are realising they can't just solve this whole issue. Transport's the biggest emitter. It's about a third of all CO2 emissions in the UK. And it can't all be solved by just trying to make it all electric. So we can't go from 38 million vehicles, make them all electric, and it'll solve everything. There's got to be a reduction in traffic. So we've got to drive less, we've got to walk more and be more active as part of the solution, even to the climate crisis.
Susan, tell us from your perspective, because you come from a slightly different place. You're a transport planner, as I said in the introduction. You work for Arup. Tell us what you work on in terms of walking and people being able to walk and cities and how we design them.
Mm-hmm. It's a whole range of things. And I think it's looking at walking both as a mode in its own right, but also the really important role it plays getting us to the bus stop, getting us to train stations. So about half the walking done in London is for public transport. So I see walking as the glue that holds the city together. But also it's really important role in town centres. There are so many struggling high streets at the moment. And for a long time, there's been the misconception that the only people who spend money are those with cars. Whereas research, including research by Living Streets, has shown that actually it's the people who walk to town centres who spend more money. They stay for longer, they make more trips, they spend more money. So it's in terms of actually some of the failing high streets. So walkability has benefits all round, including for employers like my own as well. So we know that if our staff walk or cycle to work, they tend to be happier, they tend to be more alert, they have fewer days off sick, they're more creative. So the benefits are tangible throughout the whole of a town or city.
Give us a sort of fantasy of, you know, people listening to the podcast will live in different places, cities, towns, villages, but give us a sort of fantasy for what should we aspire to around the world? Or
One of my favourite examples is a relatively small town in northwest Spain called Pontevedra, and it's often described as being car-free, but it's not. Cars are allowed, but under very controlled circumstances. So it really is strictly if you need a vehicle, and then the vehicle has to go at very low speeds and is subordinate to walking in particular. And the reason I like Pontevedra is, I said, A, it's a small place. It's only 80,000 population, so it isn't a New York or a London that other places can't relate to. But also the mayor there started giving priority to people on foot 20 years ago. He's been re-elected 7 times on that basis, which is fantastic. But also there's 20 years of experience. And the key thing is that the population in that town has gone up while surrounding towns, the population has gone down. And critically, childhood population has gone up where elsewhere it's declining. So it's a city that just puts people walking first.
How do they police the you can use your car if you need it thing?
It's a permit system.
So is that for people with disabilities, for
yes,
example?
Yes, yeah. So, you know, cars are allowed, but they're allowed in as guests, if you like. And I went there last year, but it just creates a fantastic environment for walking around because you haven't got constant traffic noise. You haven't got the risk of safety that cars bring. People are just more relaxed.
And how big is that town?
80,000 people.
So, it's not a tiny place.
No, it's not tiny, but it's not huge, because when you talk about what happens in, I said, the London or New York, people always say, but we're not London, it's different there. And yes, every place is different. But you're starting to see other smaller places in the UK. You've got cities like York that are interested, Brighton, even Birmingham, sort of now stating intentions to, it's often described as being car-free, but at least it's to reduce the dominance of motor vehicles in the areas.
Joe, tell us, what are the other major barriers to walking? Because it's not just about whether cars are banned or allowed or semi-banned, is it?
No, it's not. But it's the dominance of traffic is a big thing. So we survey people it's the speed of traffic or the amount of traffic or the danger from traffic is often high in people's minds, not least parents of children going to school. So that's a big factor. Sometimes the roads are so big and dominant that they can sever an entire community and people don't feel safe crossing the road. There's the maintenance and the look and feel of a place. Can you make it more attractive? Look at what's been done in Waltham Forest recently. It's a really attractive place now to go and walk around. I used to live there in the 80s and it certainly wasn't quite so nice then.
And in your manifesto for the election, which I read, speed limits?
Yeah, so fast vehicles are dangerous, so we know speed kills, but also they're very off-putting to people to go to a place and find it, because that's noisy, it seems dangerous, it's hostile. So we're proposing, along with cycling organisations, there should be a standard 20-mile-an-hour limit in urban areas, in built-up areas. That doesn't mean there'll be every single road, but it becomes the standard, whereas at the moment the standard's 30. And you'll see in lots of London boroughs have gone to 20 mile an hour, the City of London's gone to 20 mile an hour, and there are many towns and cities around the country are trying to do the same. It's round about the speed where people feel a bit safer.
Susan, what are the things you can do to make a street more walkable?
First of all, I think every street can be improved. There's not a road I walk down where I don't think it could be better. And quite often it's quite simple things like the surface of the paving, the condition of the footway, or is there's litter left on it, or there are signboards blocking it, or bikes, particularly bike hires, sometimes the hire bikes blocking it. TfL, Transport for London, has a healthy streets indicators, and that talks about having, you know, people from all walks of life, every pun intended, on it. It's about having shade and shelter, somewhere to rest. There are very, very few benches around, but a lot of people do need to rest or want to sit down. It's about having interesting streets. So you have interesting sort of shop frontages, not having lots of blank walls or shutters that are down. It's about having, they use the expression not too noisy, which I think is an interesting one, because people don't always want complete silence. It's having that sort of feel that there are other people around. One of the things I feel really strongly about is having things like public toilets. They are very important in making a city more walkable. So it's a whole range of things that range, you know, from greenery and seating, wider footways, not having footways blocked or obscured, ideally having fewer cars parked on them, because then it gives a safer feel. It's about having right levels of lighting. So it's lots of things that work together rather than one thing.
So we have local groups, about 40 local groups around the country. And just a little example of how you can make a difference. So the London group got in touch with Transport for London, and it was about the crossing time. So when there is a light control crossing, how long do you get to cross? And there's lots of evidence come out that there's a standard speed that the planners use, which is 1.2 metres a second. And many people, particularly older people, don't walk that
fast.
That's
a really good point.
And so they've gone round and they've done surveys and they've adjusted the timing, a lot of little crossings in London. And it's really a small thing. It's so easy to do. It's not expensive. And yet it makes a big difference. And it turns out that 1.2 metres per second, by the way, comes from a single study in the United States in the 1950s, and it's just been used by everybody ever since. And so it's not really, you know, it's not really assigned to modern people, and with an aging population, just giving a bit people more time to cross can really help.
And how do we get change? You know, sometimes it requires quite a leap to go from where we are to where we would like to be. We can sort of aspire to Pontevedra, but it's taken 20 years, and, you know, What's your view, both of you, about how this change starts to happen?
I think one of the key ways it can happen is by having trials, so people can actually see what a difference something can make. So it can be quite simple, such as closing a street to traffic at one end. Just requires a bollard, doesn't require too much work to do it, and then people can see what the result of that is. There have been some large-scale trial schemes, so Bank Junction is probably the most well-known one and the biggest one in London. So Bank Junction was closed to traffic during the working day, and after 18 months' experience, the City of London decided to make that permanent.
Right.
So that was a really good way for support to build up, because from the city, from people, because they could actually see what the change was and what the impact would be. And so I think having trials so people can actually see the change is one of the most effective ways of bringing around change.
I'd love to draw attention to Jeanette Sadiq Khan, who is the Transportation, I should say, Commissioner for New York under Mayor Bloomberg, who made radical change. And one of the things they did was to pedestrianise Times Square, which people thought, how can they possibly do that? Absolute uproar from certain quarters, and they trialed it. And they trialed it. They did the first day. They were watching it, and the road was clear, but there was nobody there. And she got in touch with people. They went to local stores and bought little fold up plastic seats, put them there. And by the afternoon, it was full, and people were sitting there reading. They were eating. They were talking with each other, and they never looked back.
And when did that happen, Joe?
So that's probably 5 years ago,
yeah, something like that. Yeah.
And then the mayor who succeeded, Mayor Bloomberg, was going to reverse that, and there was such an outcry against that that he didn't do it. So it's still pedestrianised and really thriving today.
And she's done also really good stuff, just taking out small parking areas again. So, you know, traders are normally really fearful of that. But so do a trial, take out 10 parking spaces somewhere, put down some green paint or something, get some plants, get some chairs.
Parklets.
And all of a sudden, it isn't a question of where do the cars go, it's where are the people come from. And, so it can fundamentally change the use of a place.
To state the obvious, this does also depend on the quality of public transport.
Yeah, so
to get people into city or town centres.
So a lot of the stuff in London works because you do have a public transport alternative. So there are two aspects to this, really. One is we've got to have better public transport, and as Susan said, people give up their cars for longer journeys. You need good public transport so you can walk to the bus or possibly a train or metro to make the journey. But the second thing is just planning. So being able to walk to somewhere that you want to go to. Most people, if you ask them, they want a corner shop, they want a school, with primary school at least within walking distance, probably secondary school, a doctor's, GP, surgery. In a lot of places that isn't the case, particularly new developments, because it's being rushed through without thinking through what needs to be support. Now that is a big driver of people walking and having to go further. And if there's no public transport either, you're forced to drive. And if you think of some of the new build communities, including in South Yorkshire, you'll find that the people have got no alternative. So definitely they go together.
You talked about schools earlier. Talk to us about your Walk to School campaign, because that has been very successful.
Sure. So we've been going just over 10 years, and we now in about 2,000 schools, which is about 1 million children right across the country. So what we do is we'll go into the school. We have a computer system called Travel Tracker. So each day the kids go in and they'll go, "Woomph, that's my kind of icon, maybe a penguin or something. And that's how I travel to school this day." And they've got seven options: walk, cycle, drove, whatever. So they just tap on that. So we've got this massive data, actually, which is fantastic from that. But what we say, so what WOW started off as, is if you walk once a week for a month, you'll get a badge. And we get the children take part in a big competition to design the badges. And for primary school children, it's still a really effective incentive, as Blue Peter would verify. Yeah. So it works like that. But it is about getting messages. So we'll do assemblies when we'll try and to get the message through to parents, because they're often making the decision. And we'll also go out and address the physical problems. So safety on the streets, maybe a crossing, maybe sometimes it's not even the safety of the crossing, but it's just a very forbidding sort of environment. One time I remember in Manchester, we just kind of painted up a wall, which was like a factory wall. But without that, it was just very forbidding, for people to walk along. So make it a bit bright and cheerful. And kids did it. And they get to school. They're getting some of their exercise before they get to school. And the studies say, and the teachers say, they're more alert and learn better when they're in that state.
We have a fantasy utopia on the podcast called the Jeffocracy. I'm a benign, hands-off leader, but I'm very pro-walking. If I was to make you joint walking SAR, I mean, take your pick, but I'm thinking walking SARs, head walker, what would be the first thing you would do on day one?
First thing I would do would be to implement a system of national road pricing.
Interesting. That would be tolls on roads.
Yes, or some mechanism for charging.
In London.
Yes, but I think it needs to be done at the national level, because cities are fearful of doing it because it isn't a level playing field. So I think actually having a national road pricing scheme that could be designed to deter short journeys. If it was something more sophisticated, it could deter them at certain times of the day or when air quality is poor. And I think that would be, people would then actually be more aware of their decisions. I think the big problem is once you've got a car, because the fixed cost of the car is so high, you will use it as much as you possibly can to justify that cost. So once you've got a car, you've got your car keys in your pocket, you're going to use it for virtually every trip. So national road pricing.
Joe, Walker in chief.
Oh, so I'd being a bit fiscal about this, I'd like to see some long-term investment plans. I think there's lots of stop-start and very minor funding in this area. But if you ask me for one thing that you might change in one fell swoop, I'd probably say the 20 mile an hour in urban areas. That would make a big difference to the feel of areas and make them much more attractive.
And the good thing is my national road pricing system would fund Joe's improvements.
There we go. I'm sold.
Susan Clarence and Joe Irvin, thanks so much. They've got the job.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, we're doing the up sum in a new way.
Do you know, for years when I used to be on the radio, I used to do the show stood up like this.
And Are you serious?
I turned 40 and I just thought, I'm going to start sitting down. From that point onwards,
all the shows standing up?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I'll probably give myself some back trouble in later life through standing up so much.
I was really inspired by that episode.
Yeah, me
don't
too.
You think?
Yeah.
I thought that was like, and I think you deserve a bit of credit for it because you sort of said the other week, oh, I think we should do something a bit more, you know, down to earth.
Just on it, something like that clicks on an individual basis.
Exactly.
We've been doing lots of sort of big ideas and ways to change
I think
the world.
Well done you.
Thank you.
I mean, it's just the business, this, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I can't imagine anybody's listening to this and is anti-walking.
But, you know, I think there's something interesting, which is that stuff that Shane was saying, that you psychologically feel better after walking, is something I always sort of notice, but I don't think... You just think, oh, well, I feel better after a walk. But you don't... It's just it must be a function of sort of... the way the brain works. I mean, you know, and all the stuff about you get twice as many good ideas and all of that.
And what Susan was saying, it was only something she'd noticed, but that if you see kids who've walked to school, they tend to be a bit more alert and engaged. And that I guess, would tie in with Shane's theories.
Yeah.
We all want to walk more and we want to see our towns and cities made into more walking-friendly environments.
Absolutely.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
If you've got views on walking... particularly if you're in favour of it or you can work out how we can get to this new world, please do email us. You can find more on our podcast, cheerfulpodcast.com.
Be good to get a counterpoint as well, wouldn't it?
The anti-walkers.
Anti-walkers, yeah.
Yeah, if the anti-walkers are listening, let us know. This is from Christina Turnshoff. I hope I've pronounced your name right. Dear Cheerful team, greetings from Silicon Valley.
Wow.
Wow. We're going to Silicon Valley, Jeff.
I mean, we have done quite a lot of episodes criticising Silicon Valley. We might not be welcome there.
Well, we'd be happy to have a trip, though. I'm a European transplant and PhD student in political science in faraway California. I mean, that just, at this time of year, that sounds pretty good, doesn't it?
It does. Walking in California would be fun.
Yeah. I always enjoy listening to a bit of cheerfulness from across the pond. Imagine my excitement when you did an episode on progressive trade deals, which is, in fact, my PhD topic. I loved how you made some very technical problems approachable to the general public. Well done, Jeff. There is, however, one small thing I would like to point out in the interest of nuance and accuracy. Not so well done, Jeff. Your guest from the Roosevelt Institute claimed that Bill Clinton's implementation of NAFTA in 1993 was unconditional on good labour and environmental practices. In fact, much of Clinton's presidential campaign at the time was about only passing NAFTA if he could renegotiate side deals on both labour and the environment. He did just that shortly after he got into office. Now, these side deals are often seen as too weak and leave a lot to be desired, but I still feel like claiming there was no effort at all to make NAFTA conditional on good labour or environmental practices is somewhat unfair and should not go unchallenged. Other than that, thank you for a great episode. Keep up the great work.
And where do we go from the sunny skies of California?
Well, I was going to say, we go to Silicon Valley, don't
Well,
we?
No, now in the next email. I mean, it'd be nice to go to Silicon Valley.
Yeah, it's like straight away.
Yeah, but in the immediate future, we go from Silicon Valley to Norwich.
Yes, of course!
Quiz of the week.
Norwich!
Jacob Hamilton
Who
says...
Who needs Silicon Valley when you've got Norwich? Norwich,
yeah. I heard you talking last episode about interesting places to be listening from.
Norwich!
And although I'm currently in grey, cloudy Norwich...
No!
No, it gets better.
Oh, go on, yeah.
Even better than just Norwich.
Yeah.
He says, I'm listening from my lab.
In Norwich?
He's in a white coat in Norwich.
Wow.
Like Beaker.
Wow.
Dr. Bunsen Honeydew. Yeah. Where I'm working
Over
on my
head.
PhD... Yeah, discovering
two PhDs.
Yeah, new antibiotics. Discovering antibiotics in
wow,
Norwich.
In Norwich,
resistance to these drugs is increasing. It's expected to cause 10 million
Norwich.
Deaths a year by 2050. And you know, be respectful of the 10 million.
Sorry.
Yeah. Antibiotic resistance gets barely any attention compared to the climate emergency, which is equally important.
Particularly important in Norwich.
Yeah, yeah, in of all places.
Yeah.
While listening to the podcast, I'm looking at leafcutter ant colonies.
Wow.
And seeing how they use antibiotics. I didn't know they're their own
antibiotics. Yeah. Obviously, that's where it comes from, you idiot.
Yeah, we got it from the ants.
Antibiotics.
Yeah, to help us find new drugs for humans, as well as studying new ways of using existing drugs to help combat resistance. Maybe you could do an episode of antibiotic resistance in the future. Live from Norwich, the quiz of the week.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Email us, reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Follow us on Twitter at Cheerful Podcasts, or search for our Facebook page, Reasons to be Cheerful Podcast.
And in this week's Cheerful People slot, we're joined by somebody. I mean, is this somebody you've seen grow up, Ed? What's the story here? What's your first memory? This is Grace Campbell, who is the co-host of Football, Feminism and Everything in Between, which is a podcast she co-hosts with her dad, Alistair Campbell. You do loads of stuff besides that.
My first memory
Grace,
of Grace but... is as a bump, actually.
As a bump?
Really?
Yeah, your mum.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, obviously your mum. What were you born? 1994. Yep, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
The year D-Ream Things Can Only Get Better was released.
Well, I do like to think that I inspired New Labour because my dad started working for Tony when I was like a week old.
Exactly.
Mm.
And you now are multi-hatted.
Mm-hmm.
You are a podcaster, which you host with your dad, Football, Feminism, Everything in Between. You're a comedian.
Yeah.
You're currently on tour.
Yeah.
You're writing a book.
Yeah.
Where do we even start?
Let's start with the podcast.
Yeah.
So Football, Feminism and Everything in Between. I mean, it sounds descriptive. What can you tell us about it?
I mean, it's sort of, it's me and my dad. It started from when I called him. He was hosting an LBC show about feminism.
Yes.
And I called him.
You called him out, really?
I called him out, but I didn't really like, he didn't know it was going to happen. Yeah. I didn't really know what I was going to say. And I basically called him out for all the reasons why I don't think he's a very good feminist.
He really isn't.
No, he's gotten better.
Yeah, well,
in what ways?
A low bar.
In what ways wasn't he a good feminist then?
Well, he. So the three things that I said were: you call women birds, still,
right? Okay.
You don't do anything around the house, and he uses the excuse of I can't, so I can't work the coffee machine, or I can't turn on the dishwasher because he just doesn't want to, and he's grossed out by women talking about their periods.
But so he's a work in progress. But at least he's. I mean, I felt I was on your podcast
trying.
And I felt like he's in his own sort of rather denialist way. He is sort of acknowledging that he kind of must, even the doing of the podcast must be a sort of an admission that he kind of knows.
It's the fact that he doesn't mind being sort of called out and shamed for things that he hasn't quite learned yet. And I do respect that because he doesn't get particularly defensive. He's just like, okay, I actually didn't really know what that meant, or I didn't really know how that would make someone feel, so I'm happy to change that. He just hadn't really been exposed to kind of that kind of conversation around gender and feminism.
And tell us
really.
About your book on the future of men.
It's
currently being written.
It's
work in progress, like your dad.
Progress. I've done four interviews to sort of structure it. So I've done my dad, my boyfriend, my gay best friend, and fictional interview of my future son. So it's like sort of going through the different like archetypes of men in my life. And so that those interviews have been really interesting. And actually the most interesting one was with Jack, who's my best friend, because he is talking about being a gay man, but in a very male world and having actually loads of straight men, and his observations of toxic masculinity within straight men and gay men as well. And I've gotten a lot of stuff from that. And then I guess the book, it's like a short book, it's an essay basically, 15,000 words, is a manifesto for how I think men could be better feminists.
So how can we get better?
Well, I think it's the notion that men can be feminists. So like, even my boyfriend, I've interviewed him and he's been with me for like a year and a half, and you couldn't be with me and not be a feminist. Like, it just wouldn't work. But he won't say he's one. He has this real kind of like, I don't want to say I'm a feminist because I hate men who say they're feminists just to sort of show off.
In that they're a bit too thrilled with themselves.
Yeah, exactly.
Let me tell you something. When I go and buy my wife Tampax, I really think, aren't I a great guy? And I want the person at the cash register to think, what a great modern guy there, like out buying tampons, knowing exactly how many drips she needs on the box. You know, like I do feel that I'm probably one of those annoying people.
But I think there are a lot of them, especially in the dating world. Like, when you date as a feminist, you'll meet guys who are like, yeah, of course I'm a feminist, and actually in principle they're not. Whereas my boyfriend's the opposite. In principle he is a complete feminist, but he just has this kind of weird thing about the label. So that's one barrier that we need to get over. We need to basically make feminism seem like it's something for men. You're a feminist.
Yeah,
you said that on our podcast.
Yeah, but I mean, flawed.
We're all flawed. Yeah. I've put this bit in my book, and I'm writing some material on this as well. The first time I dumped a boy, he started crying, right? And I thought it was the most embarrassing, pathetic thing. And I asked him to stop crying, and then I left, right? Which is internalized patriarchy, basically. I internalized the idea that men can't show their vulnerabilities, men can't be weak. And that was when I was 18. So I have evolved since then. But that's, you know, something that I picked up on when I was younger. So having this really strong male father who sort of was really tough. But then my dad's really interesting because he does have his vulnerabilities in his like mental health, and he is very open with that. But I always saw him as this tough man, and I always saw anyone who was sort of more
as
vulnerable
wimpish.
As wimpish, yeah. Oh, which has really changed now, but that is something that was ingrained in me.
Really,
so we're none of us are perfect.
Now, you takes us neatly on to your comedy show, which is called Why I'm Never Going Into Politics.
Yeah, fair attention-seeking title.
Well, you're compelling. Tell us about it.
The show is called Why I'm Never Going Into Politics. The subtitle of the show will be, comes here, Alice Campbell's daughter, talk about why she's never going into politics. It was my first Fringe, I wanted to sell out. So that was firstly like a marketing thing that I did, because I knew that people would come.
I think I've given you a little blurb,
haven't I? You were like the quote on my poster at the Fringe. It was like, Grace is much funnier than her dad. but the show is ultimately about like my childhood in politics, where it's brought me today. I do lots of like feminist campaigning outside of
politics. Definitely involved in politics.
Yeah, exactly.
You've gone into politics, Grace, sorry.
But why I would never want to be like a
politician.
Westminster.
And what's the top three reasons?
Well, firstly, I just think I couldn't do it. Like, I'd be a terrible one because I'd be really bad at saying things that I don't think. I'd be really bad at like not swearing on TV and radio. I still love taking drugs and I'm very open about that. I have spent the last 5 years talking about my vagina, sex, masturbation. So I sort of argue the case that firstly, I would be a bad politician, and secondly, Westminster wouldn't be able to like deal, like the right-wing media and Westminster wouldn't be able to actually keep sort of
sounds plausible.
Accepting me as a sort of feasible
sounds
member
plausible.
Of parliament.
Is part of your thing also about what you saw politics doing to your home life?
Yeah, it is. And like, it just sort of was very hard in our family home. Like, my parents are very split on the Iraq War. Yeah. That caused a lot of stuff.
But also,
he was never there.
Well, I was about to say, your dad was very absent, presumably.
He was very absent.
And even when he was present, I mean, this is like, speak from personal experience here, you can be absent.
Totally. And actually, I mean, this is sort of a bit too sort of sad to talk about in the show, but I'm talking about this in the book. Like, when he was still working in Downing Street, but he would have these really low moments of depression and sort of anxiety, and he'd be at home and he wouldn't be able to speak to any of us, and he wouldn't be able to get out of bed. But then he'd go out, or Tony would call and he'd answer and like perk up and be fine for like 5 minutes, or he'd go out and do an interview and be fine. And it was kind of like he had a different face and a different character for politics. And it was almost like, obviously that's because you show your most vulnerable side to the people that you love the most and that you feel the closest with. But when I was a kid, I did take it quite personally.
Well, for understandable reasons.
Yeah. I don't meet anyone my age who wants to have a career in politics. Maybe that's the circles that I...
How old are you?
25.
I still don't know if I've met anybody who wants to have a career in politics. No. And substantially older.
No. I don't have a single friend who's a member of a political party.
Right.
Like, they're political, but they don't see Westminster as the sort of hub of that kind of change making.
What's the next thing for you then? Are you doing Edinburgh again this year? You're writing a new show?
So I just started a comedy night called The Disgraceful Club, which is at this nightclub called The Box in Soho. And we are taking that up to Edinburgh, but I'm not writing a new show. Because
which night of the week is that?
What, in Edinburgh?
No, the
or
box.
In London. It's on Wednesday, the 12th
of February. I'm normally there on Tuesdays, so... Sorry about that, but, you know...
Have you been?
No.
Have you been, Jeff?
No, never.
Have
never.
You not?
I've seen pictures of Kate Moss falling out of there in the
what, is it
sort of early 2000s.
Yeah. Where they have all these crazy, like, sex shows, basically.
Yes, of course. Well, that's why I'm there. I'm normally there on
Yeah, that's why I was like...
It's a very specific thing on a Tuesday night.
Exactly. Now you've found out my secret.
Will you give us, before you go, Grace, will you give us a reason to be cheerful?
A reason to be cheerful?
Your reason to be cheerful?
Yeah, but I can't say it myself.
Well, I can say it, though. But, I mean, while you think of it, I mean, look, I think it's interesting, isn't it? You grew up in this new Labour household. You got quite alienated by, like, politics, big P politics. But you're engaged in politics, but in just a totally different in a totally different way, and you know possibly a more effective way. The work on feminism, you know, the podcast, all of that stuff. I think that's really. But I think in a way, doesn't it show that you kind of, whatever the flaws, you did grow up in a household where you were like you kind of. Kind of were brought up to care about the world.
Well, I think you can make a change. It's sort of a privilege to think you can change the world. Do you know what I mean? My reason to be cheerful is probably comedy. It's the thing that gets me through the day.
You got the bug.
Exactly. But not even like, I love doing it. I love writing it. It's like, at the moment, I'm doing so many other things work-wise, and the whole time, I'm just like, all I want to be doing right now is writing comedy and gigging. And watching comedy as well. All I watch is comedy.
Who's any good?
Ali Wong's one of my favourite stand-ups.
Yeah, she's coming to UK.
She is. The tickets are like £250. Sarah Baron. Huh?
Sarah Baron.
Sarah Baron, yeah.
I hear, yes. I have mixed feelings.
I've met her.
Right.
Yeah. I met her at a festival in Shoreditch. It was this like comedy festival in the summer.
Was she nice to you?
Yeah, she was really nice. We spoke in the green room for a bit.
She's very needy to be liked by people.
Yeah. Really?
Sarah?
I thought it was you.
No, I'm even more needy, but she's just better at it.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, better at hiding it and better at being liked.
Sarah Baron, definitely. Yeah. I really like her. Catherine Ryan. And I love Dave Chappelle.
Are you going to go see him?
Again, tickets are like £350. I haven't got that. I'm trying to get my agent to sort me one.
Grace, it's been brilliant.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much.
Not at all.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Well, we're in the outro.
Yeah, and we're back out. We enjoyed the episode so much that we've decided to come back out and walk.
Yep.
Yes. We're
still over.
Oh, I had a bone to pick with you.
Yeah.
Where were you last night? He said, sounded like a suspicious spouse.
I was at an event.
What event were you at?
I was at John Bercow's book launch, as you well know.
That sounds amazing. That sounds exactly the sort of... I mean, I'd love to say hello to John Bercow. I mean, what a character. I mean, surely that's the sort of thing that somebody in your position would have been able to get a plus one on his invitation.
You were my plus one. I mean, do you feel slighted?
I do. I feel like it's like George Ezra and David Attenborough all over again. This is the third slight... I don't know if I should
introduce it. I was actually at another event with David Attenborough. I forgot to tell you about that.
Anyway, was it a good night?
I mean, you at least thought about inviting me to Mamma Mia the musical.
Well, I knew you wouldn't enjoy it based on your previous comments about musicals.
That's true. And actually, you know, the reason I didn't invite you to John Berkow's book launch is I knew it was your 9th anniversary of you and Sarah meeting. And that, you know, it was a kind of, you know, time for you to celebrate that.
Right.
I just thought there wasn't, you know, I mean, you wouldn't have been able to come, would you?
Nicely touched. Should we do our thank yous?
Yes, I'd like to thank Shane O'Mara, Joe Irvin and Susan Claris.
And thanks to Grace Campbell for coming on. We'll be there at the Box Nightclub, depending on which night of the week. Oh, there we go. Yeah. Somebody waved to you. Yeah. You're feeling happy now.
Yeah.
It took to the end of the episode.
A man who looks like a younger version of you, really.
Nobody likes to hear that about themselves. So Emma Caution produces our podcast with research and backup from Joel Pearce and Joe Kenyon. Gail Lofthouse is our announcer. James Deacon made the idents. Ed Seed composed the music, and the artwork was designed by
Henry Cole.
Oh, I'll tell you what we haven't mentioned yet.
Yeah, go on.
With us being young, trendy millennials, we're on TikTok now.
We're on TikTok.
Yeah. No, I haven't looked at it. I don't know what it is. So if you want to find us on TikTok, just look for us.
He's been Walk This Way.
He's been Talk This Way.
And these have been
Reasons to Go Walking.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.